Hello, everybody, and welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. I'm Terry Patton, the creator and host of this series, and for anybody who doesn't already know me, I'm also the founder and teacher of Integral Spiritual Practice and the author of Integral Life Practice with Ken Wilber. I convened this series to advance the public dialogue that's taking place at the leading edge of consciousness and culture by asking one critical question to many people and from many perspectives. How can the growth of human consciousness enable us to truly change human culture so that we can grapple with our global crisis effectively and address the state of our world? So this is a part of a series of remarkable conversations I've had with many of today's leading thought leaders and spiritual teachers, which you can access by registering at beyondawakeningseries.com. Today, I'm joined by Marianne Williamson, and we're going to continue that discussion in a conversation we're titling, The Spiritual is Political, Why I'm Running for Congress. I'll begin by introducing Marianne, and we'll spend about three-quarters of an hour in dialogue, and then I'll make some announcements, and then we'll spend the last 15 minutes or so taking your questions. So I expect we'll finish up in about an hour today. Marianne Williamson is an internationally acclaimed spiritual author and lecturer. Six of her 10 published books have been New York Times bestsellers. Four of these have been number one New York Times bestsellers. A Return to Love is considered a must-read classic of progressive spirituality, and a paragraph from that book, beginning, "Our deepest fear is not that we're inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure," which is often misattributed to the late, great Nelson Mandela, is considered kind of an anthem for a contemporary generation of spiritual aspirants. She's been a popular guest on television programs such as Oprah, Larry King Live, Good Morning America, Charlie Rose. In 1989, she founded Project Angel Food, a Meals on Wheels program that serves homebound people with AIDS in the L.A. area. It serves about 1,000 people every day. Marianne also founded the Department of Peace campaign, a grassroots campaign to establish a United States Department of Peace. And in December 2006, a Newsweek magazine poll named her one of the 50 most influential people of her generation. And now, I'm really excited that Marianne has announced her candidacy for the U.S. House of Representatives from California's 33rd District. Like millions of others, I was deeply touched and inspired by her written eloquence when I read her amazing book, Return to Love. But I didn't actually meet Marianne personally until 2000, when I joined her in supporting John Hagelin's third-party candidacy for President of the United States. I attended a couple of rallies at which she spoke on his behalf, and we spoke afterwards. Among the many things that I appreciate about Marianne is her passionate dignity as a citizen of this world and this country. She is, I think, our most eloquent voice for heartfelt and truly engaged spiritual activism. I love that she says politics shouldn't be the least heart-filled thing we do. It should be the most heart-filled thing we do. Politics should be a collective expression of our most enlightened selves. She gives strong voice to many of my own clear understandings, and that's why I'm so excited about her candidacy and why I've already made my first generous donation to her campaign and why I invited her onto the program today. But I'm not just here as a supporter. I'm here in the same spirit she's showing up, as an engaged citizen. And therefore, I invited her to challenge her to a real conversation. Softball questions are not what this is about. We're in a crisis moment in our country and in our politics. And therefore, I'm going to ask her the hardest questions I can, trying to create a vital and probing and passionate two-way conversation in which she'll be asked to answer the toughest questions I can come up with, to answer the real objections that people may have to really getting excited about her candidacy, and give her a chance to tell us why this is the time when something real and new can actually happen, why this congressional race she's waging against Henry Waxman is the place to do it, and why she is the candidate that can actually lead a transformation of U.S. political praxis, and why we should all pay attention and actually lean in and support her. So welcome, Marianne. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we've titled this dialogue, The Spiritual is Political. How and why is that true?
Well, you know, the knee bone is connected to the thigh bone, and, you know, in the body and also in life. God didn't draw a line between the United States and Canada. God didn't draw a line between France and Spain. All those borders are artificial. So it's only the mortal egoic mind that categorizes. Now, the word politics, when you look at the Latin root, doesn't mean of the government. It means of the people. So as in the quote that you just mentioned about how politics should be the collective expression of our most enlightened selves, politics is simply that which is our collective expression. You know, it's like when you live in a house with people and you live in a bedroom on the third floor and somebody else lives in a bedroom on the second floor and everybody has their own life. But then there are some areas where you have to have a house meeting and you all come together. What are we going to do with the roof? What are we going to do with the dishwasher that's broken? What are we going to do about the parking outside? So if anything in my life should be an expression of my best self, if anything in my life should be an expression of my spiritual sense of the universe, a sense of moral relationship to other people, to a higher power, to the earth itself, to the future, living in a space of possibility. If that's the vortex that I should live within as an individual, then no less should that be what we strive for when we are acting together. And that's why I believe that as far as the spiritual moving into the political, I just think that we're living at a time in our own community of higher consciousness and so forth, where there's a lot of effort to, I call it being selectively conscious. People think, oh, I'm conscious because I'm conscious about my food. I'm conscious about my body. I'm conscious about my nutrition. I'm conscious about my relationships. I'm conscious about my living space. But not think that that, in order to truly be an expression of consciousness, has to include conscious about politics. So I think spiritual, if it's not political, remains only about me, never about the we, which by definition means it's not all that conscious. And as far as political being spiritual, I think that's what we have right now, is a politics which does not include higher questions of consciousness. That's why they're so dangerous at this point. They are about complete disconnection between head and heart, sees us only as economic creatures, or even worse, as voters. And sometimes in our community, people complain and we say, well, I don't want to be involved in politics because it doesn't have any higher consciousness there yet. How can we complain about that if we ourselves aren't putting it there? So I feel that those two belong together like head and heart belong together. We can call them separate, but that's just an artificial construct, and holding on to that separation is what's killing us. How am I doing, Terry? How am I doing? You got me so scared with your hardball question.
Right on. I so appreciate that you take this stand, because it's so clear to me, and it's very difficult, because the people who went into politics and business and who have seized the levers of power generally are people who've done less inner work. It's as if there was an either or for our generation, in which the A team, or at least a big chunk of it, went into the ashram, so to speak, and big chunks of the folks who ended up taking the levers of power were the B team. And it's kind of time to bring in the A team, and I see you getting that and beginning to rouse people, but it's a lot easier conceived and said than it is done.
Well, I have to tell you, I'm not as self-congratulatory about us as you are. I'm not so sure we're the A team and they're the B team. I'm not really enrolled in that formula, for the reason being that anytime we're seeing ourselves as A team to anybody, we're in a stance of spiritual superiority, and the A-team does not see itself as spiritual to anyone, by definition. So if we're stuck in a construct where we're better, we know more, then we don't know. So that filter doesn't actually work for me. I also think that...
Well, I grant you that. That's totally true. On the other hand, there's a great void of inner work having been done by the folks who are in most situations holding the levers of power, and it is a void that I notice.
Well, yes, but let's even if I might, I'd like to even deconstruct that a little bit. I think that there are a lot of, first of all, I think there are good people everywhere, and I think that there are people striving for consciousness everywhere. But I think, and this certainly is one of the reasons I'm running, the system itself in politics mitigates against deep reflection. It mitigates against deep wisdom because it's a completely transactional model. And because money so dominates the system, such undue influence, really a legalized corruption that we have now, people who are saying something which is we should do this because it's the right thing to do, as opposed to if we do this, we could get that this or that block of votes. If we do this, we could get this or that political financial donation. That's where the problem is, not in the people, as I see it, but in the system. And changing from a transactional model to a transformational model is the point. However, I want to go back to us because, you know, the Course in Miracles says only what you are not giving can be lacking in any situation. This is why I go back to the first thing you said, that we went into the ashram and they did the other thing. Actually, the ashram is in our mind, so the ashram has got to be everywhere. Our withhold of contribution over the last 40 or 50 years is part of how it got this bad.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that's really important. I do think that there has been a theft of democracy, really. There's been a theft of some of the highest fundamental principles of democracy. However, we left the doors open. We left the windows open. And I actually think the disengagement of our crowd is part of what allowed this to happen. So I think it's really important in any situation that we have a real clear analysis of what got us exactly to the point we're in order to behave most effectively now.
I appreciate that completely. On the other hand, it's also true that when you engage in a battle, you tend to become like your opponent. And those who have been given over, you know, there was a bit of a split after the 60s. A certain group of what was of the people who were mobilized by that new wave of consciousness that came in became much more politically involved, and another group focused on the inner work. And it is a time to reunite both. But it does seem to me that those of us who focused on the inner work have something to contribute, because we haven't become like what we would have opposed as much. And so there is a purity that needs to be brought back into the stream. And that's what I hear you articulating beautifully.
Well, thank you. And what you're saying, you know, as you're saying, our crowd sees the process as important as the goal. Gandhi said the end is inherent in the means. And that begins with a recontextualization of the quote-unquote battle. Because what you just said was, if you're engaged in a battle, you become of that. So in my campaign, for instance, I'm running, even look at the language, against an incumbent named Henry Waxman, who has been in the office for 30 years. I refuse to call him my opponent. The way I look at it, it's like we're both candidates for the same job. And the people, you know, California's District 33 will be choosing who to hire. And that creates a different context emotionally for the whole campaign. And that doesn't mean you don't point out differences where they're relevant. This person voted this way, I would vote a different way. You know, you vote out differences, you point out differences where and as appropriate. But just saying that, he is not my opponent, is, like you said, it's changing it from a battle to two candidates in what could be, and I'm not naive, but it could be conceptually a healthy competition. And I hope for the sake of my heart and his that that's what it will be.
Yeah, beautiful. Well, I see that you've characterized it that way in your website and in everything that you've said. And yet, this attempt to change the game tends to be marginalized and ridiculed by the mainstream media. We've seen that. Your friend Dennis Kucinich was very frequently ridiculed. The big splash that Barbara Marx Hubbard tried to make with Birth 2012, when it was what in the few places where it reached mainstream media, tended to be treated as suspect. You've already experienced a little bit of mainstream ridicule. How confident are you that you can overcome this very, very powerful immune system that the current oppositional paradigm has?
Well, as you and I, I'm sure, would agree, the conversation that the political status quo needs most to be having is what it mocks the quickest. But our being very smart, I think, about that is part of what's called for here. First of all, I think it has to do with whether or not we're in this together. The political status quo, a kind of self-appointed ruling class of political elite, is only as strong as we allow them to be in our minds. This is a democracy. It's a representative democracy. And what that means is that the power is to lie in the hands of the people, all people. So theoretically, what they get to think is what they get to think, but you and I get to think what we get to think, so really doesn't matter that they don't appreciate what we think because their vote isn't any more powerful than ours is. Once again, if we haven't stood within that, we can't complain. So it's less about taking the time, indulging the time, or indulging the energy to respond to those who do not understand or appreciate our conversation. The task is much less that, and much more the work, and I think it's very important work and critical work and urgent work, of harnessing the power, the political potential of the conversation that you and I are having. You and I dwell within a conversation that we honestly believe is necessary to the survival of the human race. We honestly believe that an evolution in consciousness on behalf of the human race is necessary in order to transcend the lower thought forms which lead us to behavior that is so reckless and so irresponsible and so violent towards the earth and towards each other as to literally imperil the possibility of sustaining life on earth for another 100 and 200 years. Let them mock. Let them tease. It doesn't matter. It's a democracy. Everybody gets to have their opinion. The point is for us to get to work. And so the mainstream media, it's interesting because, yeah, I've been mocked plenty in my career, but mainly early at the beginning when a certain kind of conversation that you and I are engaged in was considered fringe. Well, it's not fringe now. It's a mainstream impulse. And anybody who's not in the conversation looks a little out of it. The only place where our conversation, Terry, hasn't saturated is politics. It's already become baked into the cake everywhere else. And in politics, there are these calcified thought forms, entrenched calcified thought forms that dominate that system that, of course, doesn't want to open the door and let this in. But, hey, King George didn't want to let in the American colonists, and the slave owners didn't want to let in the abolitionists. And those who thought women should just stay pregnant in the kitchen and not vote didn't want to let in the suffragettes. And white segregationists didn't want to let in civil rights workers. Who cares? We need to stop being cowed from this kind of people-pleasing perspective by those who do not agree with us. You know, a meaningful life is not a popularity contest, and society has never been changed because the majority woke up one day and said, oh, I see the light. Society always changes because a small group of people, considered outrageous radicals by the status quo of their time, had a better idea. But abolitionists didn't just go form an abolitionist society in New Hampshire and stay there. You know, they had to take it out into the country and ultimately into the South. There were plenty of abolitionists in the South as well, interestingly enough. But you know my point. They had to actually engage the system with their ideas in order for their ideas to be as profound as they thought they were.
Well, you're speaking to a group of people through which a stream of disaffection runs deep, because people who think holistically can see that the factors corrupting our democratic system and preventing us from breaking this ridiculous sleepwalk into disaster are myriad, complex, interconnected, deeply systemic. And that, therefore, even when something breaks through, like Barack Obama's election to the presidency, which so many of us had so much hope for, you know, doesn't end up creating much of a difference. How much will you really be able to do? You know, if you're able to break through all this and be elected, how much will your presence in Congress really be able to change things? And therefore, why should we get our hope up yet again?
Well, I'm not naive, and no voter and no supporter should be naive. electing one woman to Congress, any woman, including myself, is not going to change the world. That's not what this is about. But my election to Congress will help open a space that allows more and more people to consider the possibility of another way being available to them as well. We need more than one new person in Congress. We need actually a spate of independent candidates who are speaking from another place. And I think that this candidacy will help to create a container among people like yourself, like myself, where stepping into that container with a message of higher consciousness is not considered impossible and is no longer considered unwinnable. And so that's what this is about. This is about a collective effort. This isn't just about me. It's about all of us. This isn't about me finding my political voice. It's about all of us finding our political voices. This isn't just about me stepping up. It's about all of us stepping up. And it's part of a larger movement of global transformation. I just don't know how we can sit here talking about a movement of global transformation and leave out this unbelievably huge elephant on the table. And the old allopathic model of politics, which is what we need to transition out of, sees politics as simply what I would do when I was there. But we both know our crowd is very clear about the fact that this isn't just about what we do, it's about who we are. And what conversations then emerge more probably in our presence because we are there. You know how that is. It's the consciousness we bring. And I feel one of the reasons I'm running where I'm running is because I feel, you know, there are places, let's say on the East Coast, you were talking about the differences where this might be mocked. But many people in District 33 do not feel, you know, are not mocking the fact that I say I want to represent more than your interests. I want to represent your consciousness. And I feel that in this district, I can be heard. And I feel I hear people in this district because I think there is, in California and all over the country, but I think there's a concentration here, of very creative thinkers who are already proving they're ready to take a next step in consciousness in their own lives and are totally ready to take it out into the world as part of a political movement. And that's, I don't see how we get out of this alive if we don't.
I totally agree that we have to begin somewhere. And yet you're stepping into an arena that is, as I said, tightly bound with a certain immune system. John Hagelin, who we both supported and admired and appreciated, was on this show last year, and he told me he's shifted his focus into bringing meditation into public schools because he thinks he can be more effective there than he was able to be by running for office. And you're making a different choice, and you're even, I think, ultimately suggesting that we might want to invest some time, money, and hope in your candidacy. So you're seeing an opening as you sit here or stand here on the playing field of our time. You're seeing an opening. You want the ball. You want to run downfield. Tell me, what are the excitements that draw you? Where do you see the potential victories? Because many of us are in a mode of learned helplessness, having gotten our hopes up again and again, seemingly had the lesson driven home that nothing seems to be able to change.
Your questions bring up so many pieces, and I hope I can remember all of them. First of all, I want to start with the John Hagelin point. John Hagelin was quite a few years ago when he did that. When was that candidacy? It was decades ago now.
It was 2000, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So that was 13 years ago. Our community was not ready to hold it. He was ready to step out. We weren't ready in enough numbers and in enough depth to surround him and to help create a container for that message. That's number one. Number two, I think it's real important he did it because it's like an assembly line. I mean, everything adds to everything. So the fact that something didn't have a goal, that his candidacy, for instance, did not lead to his election as president, does not mean it didn't add to the field of possibility. You were there, I was there, all of us were touched by it. So when you look at life through the lens that we do, looking at causal elements and so forth, it was a win. It just wasn't a win that led to a certain kind of result. As far as the immune system, you know, when you say this business, it's the one place, Terry, where it's interesting, where you and I begin, at least, in our conversation with a slightly different view sometimes is, oh, poor us. We had our hopes up. I mean, come on, really. We had our hopes up with Barack Obama. Yes, we did. So what does that mean for most of us in our community? Yeah, we supported him for president. What we got to see from what happened next was, whoa, how the system works. Now, I don't have a codependent relationship with the president that I think many people do, where I just assume, oh, poor baby, he wanted to do the right thing, but he tried, even when there's no evidence sometimes that he wanted to. So what we might call the right thing. But I think no matter how you look at what happened after that election, is that absolutely you and I got far more savvy about what really goes down here. That shouldn't make us, I mean, we're not children. This idea of infantilizing ourselves all the time just is unattractive to me. This shouldn't make us go, oh, poor us, we're helpless. What if the abolitionists had done that? What if the women's suffragettes had done that? What if the civil rights workers had done that? No, it's time for us to go, whoa, this is even bigger and even heavier than we thought. What are we going to do now? And what we're going to do, like I said, we did learn, you're absolutely right, from that election, from that phenomenon of the president's election, that we can't just look to one person to go fix it. We're going to have to create a field. We're going to have to create a container. It's going to have to be Congress people all over. Because even in the best of scenarios, if his intentions were the best, if he didn't have a Congress that was vibrating at the same in the same way that we who helped elect him were, then there was going to be a limit to what he could do. So what we need to do is to see, okay, now we're going to go for Congress. Now we are going to help create a field of political possibility out of which candidates will emerge for the Senate, for the House, for the presidency. We just have to, you know, if they got strong in life, we have to get stronger. You know, the disease, you're right. Ego has an immune system. Ego doesn't say, oh, okay. It's always there. And we just, any situation is an invitation to dig deeper and step up higher. So we see what's happened. Learned helplessness, cynicism, or just excuses for not helping. Now we have to get really serious and really savvy and really strong. And that means that we have to send, you know, some people say, oh, I have my hopes up, but they hadn't sent a dime. You know, so what do you mean you had your hopes up? Hope is born of real participation in hopeful solutions. So I think if we want the kind of field of possibility that we're talking about here, we're all going to have to step up, whether it's sending $5, using our social media to spread the news about candidacies that we do think express our hearts and resonate with our own truths, and really get involved. You know, something like this, like I said, this isn't just about me. This is about all of us if we want to step forward with a greater field of possibility. Individuals just get used. But also, it's not just about District 33 of California. I mean, once you're talking about an office of national leadership, then it's something that affects all of us, whether it's a representative of our district or not.
That's so true. What I was bringing forth wasn't so much that I feel a codependent relationship with Barack Obama or a poor us, but I'm involved in conversations all the time with people in this field of spiritual development, and many, many people are arguing against getting too involved in politics directly. Many people are essentially saying, change to a different channel. Don't listen to the news.
Well, that's real convenient.
There's a strong argument.
Yeah, it's a what argument?
There's a strong voice essentially arguing against the level of commitment that you're advocating for.
Yeah, I think it's a loud voice. I wouldn't say it's a strong argument at all. It's a very convenient argument, isn't it? I don't have to get my hands dirty. 17,000 children a day are dying of hunger, but I get to use some counterfeit form of spirituality as an excuse for why I'm not helping. There is no serious spiritual path which gives us a pass on addressing the suffering of other sentient beings, period. So you can call it all kinds of things, but the idea of calling that argument anything approaching a spiritual one needs to be laughed at as the joke that it is.
Well,
Terry, I've been around this field for, you know, I've been doing this for 30 years. I've heard it all. And I, you know, I've never been known as one who coddled anybody. I think part in my career, I think one of the things that in some ways makes me has given me a little bit of different perspective and vantage point from a lot of the other transformational teachers is that at the very, very beginning, from the earliest days in 1983, there were people dying all around me because I started my career in Los Angeles and the AIDS crisis burst on the scene. And so that deeply imprinted my work. It deeply imprinted perspective. Let's talk about what real suffering is. Let's talk about what real pain is, and a real sense of, oh, shut up and pick and help us here. Do you know what I'm saying? There was no, when people were dying, there was not a lot of room for some of the what I see as less mature conversation that can so often emerge if we're not careful in a transformational context. Everything and everyone has a shadow, and that includes our crowd. So, you know, I just feel that there is no spirituality that's not love in action. And when you look at the, you know, this idea that, you know, there are people marching in front of me being taken to a concentration camp, but don't bother me, I'm oming at the moment. To me, that's not my read of the spiritual literature or the spiritual conversation that, to which we've all dedicated ourselves.
I totally agree with this. And I think that this implies some very interesting things, like a different spirit of political engagement where instead of it depleting us, we're fed.
Exactly.
A spirit of engagement with politics that doesn't seem to drain our joy, but actually brings us together. A political party that feels like a party, that's a spiritual party in which the best parts of us are brought forward. And I sometimes feel that when I hear you speak, and I'm interested to know how you can be the focus point for some of that, building enough energy to become a standing wave to not only elect you, but be a bigger phenomenon than you're just your candidacy.
Well, you know, I think it's very analogous to the career I've had for the last 30 years. Because when I started speaking, started lecturing, there was a handful of us. And, you know, now, you know, there's a goddess priestess person around every corner, you know, there was a door that was kicked in. And one of the reasons I'm doing this is that I feel I have another door I can kick in. And what makes me happy is that I feel that if my colleagues and my contemporaries and people who share this conversation help me here, if everybody sends, $5, that was my fundraising plan from the very beginning, is, well, if all the transformational types send $5, you know, if I receive the kind of support on every level, not only financially but energetically, social media, conversation, creating buzz, voting, then this will open a space that whether I win this election or not, I think will afford the possibility in a way that does not exist now, or at least the probability that yourself, many people listening to this, many people who share these views with us, will find themselves running in 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years. We have to start somewhere. I'm just one imperfect human being. That's all any of us are. So it's not about the soloist anymore. It's about the song. But somebody has to sing the first note. And I also think, you know, you were talking about John Hagelin. This isn't even really the first note. I mean, there have been a lot of moves, and I think there are people in Congress who, you know, they're cool people. They read the same books that we read, and they're stuck within a sick system. It's just that I sort of can afford to go there and say so, because if I don't get elected the next time, I still have a day job, hopefully.
Good. Well, let me hit you with a few more hard
questions. Does that
questions.
Make sense? Did
That's
I make sense?
Great. That's great, Marianne. And let's keep rolling along because we don't have that much time here. Now, another objection that people may have is they look back at the 2000 election and feel like Ralph Nader cost Gore the presidential race, and that third-party candidacies are futile, and couldn't your campaign end up electing Bill Bloomfield, his last opponent, who was a more conservative candidate than Waxman? And if that's how it would go, shouldn't people just unite behind Waxman, who's at least been on the right side of a lot of key issues?
Well, that's such an important question. I'm glad that you brought it up. The answer is no, it couldn't, because of the calculus of the open primary that California has. There is no way that this can be like you just said, because California's open primary means that the top two vote getters in the election on June 3rd then go to the midterm election in November of 2014. So it won't be in the midterm elections of 2014, there won't be three candidates. So there's no vote that can be split. So if Bill Bloomfield does run again, and we don't know yet whether or not he will, he apparently is undecided, or at least has not announced publicly his decision, and last time did not get into the race till the deadline in March, I think. So at the primary, June 3rd, you could have, let's say, Waxman and myself, two progressives, Waxman and Bloomfield, so you still get a progressive in November. Or you get Bloomfield and me, which means you still get a progressive on the ballot in November. And then, of course, who else? You know, a gentleman named Brent Roskey is running and other people are running. But the point is there is no possibility of, quote-unquote, splitting the vote in a Nader-like way because of the way the California open primary works.
Perfect. That's a full and sufficient answer. Let's go to another one, though. You know, you're a tremendously inspiring speaker, but you must have your own personality quirks and past history and enemies. Everybody's got an Achilles heel, don't they? If you're successful enough to pose a serious threat to Henry Waxman, won't the campaign turn negative and make an issue out of people you've offended or these whatever skeletons people can find or invent in your closet, you know, characterizing you as a New Age nutcase, unfit to serve in Congress? Why should we believe that you're built for the whole trip and able to withstand the incredible pressure of the thing you've undertaken?
Well, we'll see, won't we? But I tell you, it will make all the difference if people like yourself send me an email, call me up, say, Marianne, Carrie here, just want you to know I'm thinking of you. I want you to know everybody saw that article, but we're thinking of you, sending you good vibes, girl. It's going to make all the difference. And that really is what this is about. I have experienced some of what you're saying. It was extremely painful in my life. But that was a while ago. And this society has moved forward. I just think they've been so mean to everybody. I think calling somebody a New Age nutcase makes us all go, what does that even mean now? Do you know what I'm saying? I also think that my work, regardless of what others might say, I think my 30-year career speaks for itself. I think I've had a serious career. I've written serious books. I founded serious organizations in the nonprofit world. I'm on the board of a serious organization. So at a certain point, you know, people say to me, how can you do this? For just what you're saying, Carrie, this is so brutal. You're so brave. It's going to be so brutal, just in the ways that you just said. But I've been thinking to myself, we have a pretty low bar on what we consider brutal. Brutal to me is getting stoned to death for adultery. Brutal to me is you can't leave the house without a male relative, and even then you have to have a burqa on, whether you want to or not. And if you step out of line, you could be lashed publicly by the morality police. That is brutal. So what is not only risked here, but almost surely to come, as you described, is humiliating lies and embarrassing, embellished stories and bad pictures of me in the press. What kind of woman am I? And where are we dwelling within ourselves that we consider that too hard to take? When you look at what the abolitionists went through, when you look at what people who were marching for civil rights had to go through, when you're looking at what the women's suffragette movement, what those women went through. I mean, have we become such a wimpy generation that it takes that much and we're coward and we go home? So my hope is like what I was saying before about John. John went out on a limb, and not enough of us were there to help fortify him. My hope is that my friends and my colleagues, that there are enough of us recognizing the importance or the significance of this field of possibility. If you feel, and if people feel that I'm doing a decent job at this, that people will get on their Facebook and will get on their social media and will do what it takes to say, you know what? We all need to speak back to that. We all need to stand up to that. And like I said, give me a an encouraging word or two, because I know that will make all the difference.
Right on. Well, you'll have me in your corner in exactly that way, Marianne. And that's why I'm asking you this hard question right now, is because I take the whole thing seriously.
I can tell that. I appreciate it.
You know, you've made money and lobbying, money in politics, a central theme of your issue. You have many important messages on gun control, the two-party monopoly, the incarceration industry, a lot of issues that I'd like to get into more with you, but we have limited time. But I want to focus on money.
Well, I was
money
told
and politics.
We had to just don't worry about time. Just take what you need. I have a vigilant staff, but you know, we can talk as long as you need to talk.
Well then, let's lead with this question about money, and maybe we can get into some more of that. But money and lobbying is such a serious problem, and you've spent time working with the citizen lobby group Results. Do you have insights into where the system works, where it breaks down? There's an irony here in, you know, the main way I can support you, because I don't live in your district, is to contribute money. Maybe I can volunteer some skills. I'm bringing you to the attention of people who are listening to my show. But there's an irony in bringing money to your campaign when the central tenet of it is your opposition to Citizens United and your desire to get money out of politics, saying that money is not speech, corporations aren't people. You know, are you not going to take money from PACs? How do you address this irony that, in a way, you've got to be a money-raising machine for a while if you're going to really launch a serious candidacy here?
And sophisticated people understand that. But let's look at what we're talking about. As I said earlier, if everyone would please send me $5. You know, when you're talking about individual contributions, the maximum is $2,600. I don't think any politician is going to be doing the bidding of a particular person because they sent them $2,600 or $52 for the entire campaign. Now, yes, I will not be taking special interest money. Absolutely, I will not be, because you said that would be completely antithetical to what I'm doing here. What we have in this country, particularly since Citizens United, which provided through a Supreme Court decision, I think a horrible Supreme Court decision that many of us feel will go down in history as one of the worst, it provided for unlimited anonymous donations that could be given, whether it's by corporations, individuals, or union, wherever money lies, right, to so flood the advertising issues campaigns around certain things as to almost surely be able to elect or to defeat particular candidates. Now, that means that money has such a completely undue influence, disproportionate influence on the system, as compared to that which is wielded by the individual citizen. And as long as money, financial leverage, determines political influence, where does that, for instance, leave children? Children don't work, therefore they have no financial leverage. So what you then get is what we've got, a lack of universal preschool, even though we know that children who do not go to universal preschool are in peril because they start day one of kindergarten behind in their reading. They don't read yet. All the other little kids have started to. If we don't catch them up within 2 years, by the second grade, they're on a 50% probability track to incarceration. And if we don't catch them up 2 years after that, by the fourth grade, you can see a correlation between how American children cannot read in the fourth grade and how many prison beds will then be built. There are no environmental safety standards in America's public schools, and we know that 40% of all teachers and students are already adversely affected in their respiratory systems because of that. We do not have paid maternity leave, even though we know that children who are able to stay in the arms of the mothers and the fathers for the first weeks and months of life are completely ahead of other children in terms of the numbers regarding criminality, learning dysfunction, and so forth. So in other words, the money, those who have money are able to have their interests. Quite simply, the system serves those with money more than it doesn't. And that is because of the money that floods the system. However, until that is changed, until we have public funding of our federal campaigns, which we cannot have until there's a constitutional amendment, the Supreme Court has spoken. But the founders did not create a system in which the Supreme Court is meant to lord over us. the people still have a right to have the final word, and that would include a movement all the way up to and including a constitutional amendment that outlaws undue influence of money on our political functioning. That would then pave the way for congressional legislation to establish public funding. Until then, it takes money to wage a campaign. You know, a lot of people say, well, you know, why do you need money? Why do I need money? Who do you think's going to build the website? Why do I need money? Who do you think's going to do all that digital stuff? Why do I need money? Who do you think's going to organize all those volunteers in a 750,000-person district? You know, the people who are showing up to help in a political campaign, many of are volunteers, but some are people who are working, you know, working long hours every day. They have to get paid. They have to eat. So I think that, you know, like I said, this is a grassroots campaign. I'm not getting my money from the pharmaceutical industry, not getting my money from defense manufacturers, who, by the way, I'm not worried that they're going to be, like, offering that money, but of course I wouldn't take it. But I am offering individual citizens whose cap is $2,600. And in our field, and I do need, you know, at least $2 million, Terry, to be competitive here. But my hope is that people, for instance, who are listening to this right now, who feel a yes in their heart, will go to MarianneForCongress.com and give $5. I mean, I think that there is a level on which investing financially in what we feel strongly about is part of a conscious life. I mean, some people are, you know, would say, oh, I don't, you know, I don't have that kind of money, or well, they wouldn't invest it, and yet, you know, they're going to pay hundreds of dollars for the next online seminar, so give me a break here. This is part of having been around a long time, you know.
Well, this is exactly true, and there are a lot of people who have more money, but we look back maybe on the money that we contributed to Barack Obama's 2008 primary campaign or his general election campaign. We look back on past forays, and there is this sense that those of us who are conscious have to make a bigger sacrifice in some ways, because there are big institutions funding the candidacies of the candidates who represent the status quo, and it's just us caring people who are going to finance your candidacy or other candidacies like yours. So in some sense, a greater burden falls on us. And I think perhaps there's an issue here about how we relate to that, because we're going to have to find a way to, in a sense, give of our lifeblood in a way that doesn't leave us feeling depleted. And that probably relates even to political contributions. And you know, without that turning into some kind of wishful thinking, you know, how can you frame that as a actual challenge to people's practice?
Well, you know what, though? It goes back to that $5. It goes back to how many of us there are. If you look at all of the people who read the kinds of books that we read and are part of the kinds of teachings and conversations that we're part of, there are so many. I mean, if everybody on my Facebook and Twitter gave me $5, I would be competitive. So I think it's more a matter of our reminding each other that not only is $2,600 the maximum, no amount is too small. I think a lot of people say, I think she's great, but, you know, the only thing that would be convenient for me to give would be $10, and I don't even live in her district. Well, the issue is, you know, that $10 would be helpful. So, and who among us can honestly say, who would be listening to your program, that $5 is a sacrifice? And if $5 is a sacrifice to you from a metaphysical perspective, you really need to be investing $5 in something that you believe in in order to generate a more, the universal machine here of abundance. And I
well,
think
that's true. I mean, tithing is an ancient practice in which giving some part of what's given to you is part of what primes the pump or greases the engine so the flow can keep going.
Mm-hmm. And it's not that a political contribution technically is a tithe, but just the idea of investing with your money in what you believe in. And, you know, you were talking about, you know, what about those of us feel, yeah, I invested in Obama and look, you know, whatever. There's nothing in life that's a guarantee. You know, there's no guarantee that of anything, particularly with a political candidate. And that's what a political race is about. And people have to look into their hearts and see what they think. What I'm submitting is a particular set of issues and values that I feel strongly about. I'm submitting that for the last 30 years I have stood on these things. I'm submitting that the results of my having stood on those things are there in my books, in my work, and I'm asking people to look in their hearts and see whether there's an internal yes for them, whether or not to support me in this effort, whether or not they feel that a support for this campaign is a support for the things they believe in occurring in the world.
Mm-hmm. Now, Marianne, there are some issues that you have championed that are already on the radar of the national political conversation and seem to have been completely checkmated by the stuckness of our current left-right divide and culture war. And the one I'd like to bring forward is gun control. I love what you have to say about gun control, but I appreciated that President Obama, that most of the Democrats in Congress were all willing to support gun, well, not all the Democrats, a significant number of Democrats in both houses of Congress were. And electing you won't change the electoral math in terms of the votes for gun control, but you're speaking about it. Is that because the way you're speaking about it might change the conversation or shift the momentum? What can happen that could shift that particular issue?
Money in politics is the cancer underlying all the cancers. It's the issue underlying all the issues. The only thing that will ultimately break the stranglehold of the NRA is a move that would remove their capacity to dominate the electoral map with money the way that it does. That's the only thing. Until we get money out of politics, no matter that the vast majority of Americans actually do want, for instance, universal background checks, and no matter how many Americans might want to ban assault weapons, none of that's going to happen as long as the NRA is able to wield the influence that it does in the ways that I described, particularly since Citizens United. Let me tell you how Washington works, Terry. Some very highly paid corporate lobbyist in a very nice suit walks into a congressperson's office. And by the way, this is legal. This is why this is so awful. The situation I'm about to describe to you is not illegal. It's a legalized system of corruption and bribery that we have here. So that lobbyist walks into the office and with a real smile on his or her face says the following. Hey, Congressperson, how are you doing? It's lovely to see you today. Listen, I just want you to know we will be spending $15 million on that campaign around that issue. And we certainly hope that you'll be with us, Congressman. We really like you, would love to see you with us, and just hope you will be and hope you realize that is what we will be spending on that campaign, on that particular bill next year. And the Congressman or the Congresswoman just looks at them and says, well, thank you for coming. Thank you for coming by. What they were just told was, we're going to be spending money on that issue. Now, if you're going to support us, then we will leave your district alone. If you are not going to support us, that's where our money will go. Now, remember, with Citizens United, it doesn't go into the coffers of their campaign, but it goes into advertising around that issue in that district in the way that makes it obvious to the voter who stands how. So it's all done very politely. Now, hi, Congresswoman, we just want you to know we will be spending that money. Now, for me, my tie, my heart here does not have to do with holding on to my seat. It has to do with expressing my voice. So even if in such a situation that would certify that I would then go down electorally, oh, I wouldn't be quiet about it. Now, in an issue like that, of course, because of the district I live in, I would know that in my district they would be supporting me in that. But that's the way the system works. And that's why until we get money out of politics, the NRA and the oil companies and the chemical companies and big agriculture and the prison industry all the way down the line will continue to wield the power that they have. And politicians will continue to be saying, vote for me, I'll fight for you. We need to ask why are our basic rights to life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, basic healthy environment, healthy food, healthy access to capital, healthy access to education, healthy access to political influence that should be considered minimum in a democracy, why is that such a fight all the time? We need somebody who more than fights the good fight. We need somebody who who articulates why is it such a fight? Oh, it's the money and politics. And there are people in Washington. I mean, you know, Al Franken is on this, onto this. Sherrod Brown is onto this, and people outside this politics. You know, Robert Reich, Move to Amend, Common Cause. This is a movement that has to take hold in the society, inside and outside politics, or the will of the American people will continue to be overridden by moneyed powers, which have absolutely nothing to do necessarily with how the majority of people are thinking and feeling. And gun control is one of them.
Now, there's a clarity, and one of the things that I notice every time you speak about politics is that the quality of inspiration that I've felt when you've led a group of people in a powerful, heartfelt prayer comes through in a way that cuts through. And I think that many of the people who have been playing the political game for a long time have just been, well, beaten down or wearied by the quality of the discourse that gets reinforced by the media and by everybody they're in conversation with. I think one of my hopes is that your presence in this arena will revivify the quality of the discourse itself, so that a certain amount of the healthy indignation, the clarity that I am a citizen and that this is my country and I own it as much as anyone else does, and the sense of disenfranchisement and learned helplessness, you know, actually gets shifted because you're able to stand in that and regenerate that current powerfully enough. But there's a vision that is more than just rhetorical. Like, I get how having you on that, in that scene, on TV, in the dialogues on the news shows, you know, would help our world. But there's a function right there in the Congress that you're seeing. You're seeing opportunities here that are beyond just the fact that you have a golden tongue. And I'm curious to hear more about exactly what those are.
Well, I think that I'm not sure, Terry, on that one, and I totally understand the question. But so you're saying what are the gifts or the skill set that I could bring to the job other than articulation of these things?
And what are the opportunities that having the job will give you?
Yeah. Well, you know, I, for 30 years, I've been working in a field where people don't necessarily come to me because things are going well in their lives. So whatever skill set I've developed has a lot to do with the transformation of crisis into opportunity. And when people's lives are in trouble, then what we learn, those of us in the field of higher consciousness, transformation, et cetera, is that you can't just do little fixes on the outside. You have to address the serious questions, a real inquiry into who you are and what you stand for and whether you are what you say you are and why that matters and how the universe will not support you if you're not and how the universe will support you in renewal and rebirth once you course correct and how you need to face your own shadows and how you need to own your own mistakes and make amends where necessary, and that if you do this inner work, life will transform, there will be a new beginning. But if you don't do this inner work, then it is unreasonable to expect. Now, I would go to Congress with this kind of perspective. Congress now is a very allopathic place. It's all about just treating the effects of things. There's no sense of cause, and there's no sense of the whole person. So I feel that if you know the rules of consciousness that change one life, then you know what changes the world, because all that a nation is a group of individuals. And also, if you understand causal issues, then you make an argument, for instance, about why it's important to take care of our children that otherwise would not be made with the same level of moral authority, I think, because it's saying if we do not take care of this, we will have these problems. And at a certain point, you won't be able to build enough prison beds. You won't be able to drop enough bombs in order to deal with the effects of the desperate behavior that was almost inevitable given that there was this large group of desperate people. And like I said, if I am supported in this race, if people do join, if people do send money, if people do get on their social media, if people do start a buzz in our community, if people all on and on and on so that I win, then there would be more possibility of other congresspeople, other people who are actually winning election, local, state, and federal, who are also involved in this new conversation a conversation that isn't new to you and me. See, that's why we're an important community to contribute to the field, because this is a conversation we're in. This is a conversation the country needs to be having about itself. So what I bring, and what I think a lot of people who are in your audience and our field would bring and could bring and should bring, and I hope will bring, is this level of conversation. And if we have enough of them, for instance, if we had 18 independent candidates, independent Congress people in the House of Representatives, that would change the system. You know, systems don't change only because a majority, you know, the majority didn't wake up and say, let's free the slaves. It's always a small group of people, usually considered, you know, the outliers, the outrageous radicals by the status quo of their time. And it's interesting because there's a sociological term, local discontinuity. There's something of local something discontinuity. I can't remember the exact phrase. And what it points out that's so interesting in this kind of Malcolm Gladwell type of way is that the forward movement and evolution of any system rarely comes from a place you would rationally predict. So if you look at our field, that's the last place that you would have expected the next big political movement to emerge from. And yet if you look at it non-rationally, of course it would emerge from here, because it's the deeper conversation about what is and what can be. Another interesting thing about that to me is if you look at the founding of the United States of American democracy, if you look at abolition, if you look at women's suffrage, at how important the Quakers were. So the non-rational spiritual field has been behind most of the great social political movements in American history, and of course civil rights movement. Martin Luther King was a reverend. It was in that, you know, Southern Christian Leadership Council. So the idea that spirituality has never been involved is ridiculous. With the Quakers who gave birth to all that stuff, and then of course Martin Luther King and his Christian cohorts.
I so resonate with this. One of the things that bothers me is that the media tends to cover most of us who engage in politics, certainly this is how Denis Kucinich was covered, as extreme left-wingers, whereas we conceive ourselves as transpartisans, people who are standing outside the usual divides. Do you have any sense of how you can express yourself such that you're able to make that visible despite the kind of blurring of this distinction that's going to likely take place in a fair amount of the media coverage?
I'm going to wage this campaign in the same way I have lived my career for 30 years. I decided a long time ago, if I was in the back row of the audience, would I be impressed? The calling of my heart is not first and foremost to win a seat in Congress. The calling of my heart is to speak my truth, which I believe is coming from some deep American place in me and that I feel is shared by others. I've always felt in my career, and I feel it now, that I'm not saying anything everybody I know isn't saying it. I'm just saying it while the mic is on. And I feel that what some people would call a radical leftist conversation is actually just a radically American conversation. And there is a radicalism to democracy. It's that, no, it's supposed to be a government of the people, by the people, for the people, not a government of a few of the people, by a few of the people, and for a few of the people. Our government has it completely wrong. It sees democracy as subservient to capitalism, and I believe that capitalism should be subservient to democracy. To me, that's just American. And I say that as someone who celebrates capitalism. I mean, I'm a writer. I write a book. Somebody buys it. I understand about the high side of fair exchange. But what we've developed in this country is a kind of predatory capitalism that is not about fair exchange. It's about squeezing as much out of you as possible so I can get more and you'll be left with less. That's corruption. And that's immoral, by the way. So you know, you want to call that leftist? Fine. I think it's actually conservative as well as liberal, because it's, you know, conservatism means you conserve those things which are eternally true. I'm all for holding people accountable. I'm all for saying to a young person, get off your butt and work hard, and that's how you're going to make it. But not for a system in which, when that child is so tiny that they can't get themselves up on the first rung, that we don't put them there. I mean, when my daughter was 2 years old, I didn't make her, you know, climb up into the attic and work hard at cleaning the attic. She was too little. once she was old enough, you bet I did. So, you know, once again, that all that projection and, you know, if we want to be lazy thinkers and hold on to the old calcified filters, then people can get very sucked in by that. And it will take all of us articulating a vision that we believe in. And if we do, I mean, look, Terry, our field has already had tremendous power in this society. We just haven't yet collectively tweaked it for political purposes. And it's not that hard. It's simply the intention to do so. Even
and
going back to that.
That's right. And sustaining that and building that as a field
it's
that
just
isn't
a habit.
Just held by.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. We just haven't developed that habit. And that's all it is. And I hope that this campaign will help make that happen. We'll see how people feel. And if people recognize something there and say, and you feel that internal yes, and people do, all I can say is that I would do my very best to be worthy of that, of the honor bestowed on me by those efforts.
Well, beautiful. Now, I know that many of you have already typed in questions in the Instant Teleseminar window. If you're calling in by telephone and you'd like to ask a question of Mary Ann live, we will be giving some preference to actual voices. Please press star 2 on your telephone keypad. And if you're listening online via computer and you haven't already typed a question, go ahead and do that now. I want to let make sure that you know how to find out more about Mary Ann's candidacy. There are two websites you should know about, MaryAnnForCongress.com. That's about the campaign and the issues. And MaryAnn.com is a place where you can find out more about her other work, writings, audios, and videos. And if you're inspired by what you're hearing from her today, there are three ways you can help her. First is to donate money, as she said. Although she's committed to getting money out of politics, she's not going to be able to succeed except by raising a lot of money. And as I said in my introduction, I made a generous donation. I encourage you to do so, too. The place to do that is at MaryAnnForCongress.com. And now, for anybody who's not as computer literate, Mary Ann, is there an address where they can send a check?
You know what? First of all, thank you for that. I'm looking on my site right now to find that address for you. If somebody goes to the donate page at MaryAnnForCongress.com, or MaryAnnWilliamsonForCongress.com, they will find that it is a P.O. box, and I have one digit that I can't remember. I will try to find it here. But I think they'll probably want to go to the website anyway, because the website will also tell them, for legal purposes, all the things you have to include there. You have to tell your address, you have to tell your employer, and all of that kind of stuff. So people should go to MaryAnnForCongress.com, MaryAnnWilliamsonForCongress.com, and look at that donate page anyway, and they will see the address there.
Very good.
Thank you.
Sure. There are a couple other ways you can help, too. One is to get the word out to others in the way that I'm doing right now. And one way to do that is to go to her website. You can download graphics. You can put up on your Facebook page or Twitter page. You'll get an email this week from us with a link where people can download the recording of this interview, and you can forward that to people who also might find it inspiring, along with the URL for her website, MaryAnnForCongress.com. And then if you live in or near West Los Angeles, there's a lot you can do as a volunteer. But even if you don't, you can go to MaryAnnForCongress.com and look at the list of skills that are needed, and you can offer to help out. And for anybody who will be in the L.A. area in January, there are three important upcoming events you should know about. On Wednesday, January 8th, she's going to be holding her monthly town hall at Topanga Community Club in Topanga Canyon. Friday, January 10th, she'll hold her first major yoga fundraiser with Sean Korn and others at the Golden Bridge Yoga Studio on North Highland Avenue. And on January 29th, her monthly issues forum will have a special guest, Professor Adam Winkler of the UCLA Law School, on the topic of money and politics. That's at the Santa Monica Bay Women's Club in Santa Monica. Additionally, I want people to know how, about my work. Even if you are already on the Beyond Awakening list. Now, you can get there by going to beyondawakeningseries.com and signing in. But There's also a separate mailing list for my work, terrypatton.com. I invite you to go there, read my blog, find out more about my upcoming events and working with me individually, and also get on my personal mailing list. So let's see if we have some questions. And it's taking me a minute because I went over to your website.
Yeah. Thank you so much for this, Terry, by the way. And thank you so much for the donation. I'm so grateful to you.
Sure. Well, we have one person who wrote in, hey, I want to give $2,000, Betty Mason in Lantana. She wants to know where to send it. That's good to be seeing.
Well, thank you so much, first of all, and I'm very grateful for that. She goes to the website, to the Marianne for Congress website at .com, and I'm opening this myself right now. I can give her the address that has to do with where you send it if she doesn't want to do it online. The address would be...
Do
you see it there? Do you see the
postal? It's funny, I'm finding the... here it is. Mail check to Marianne Williamson for Congress, 1507 7th Street, number 7B, Santa Monica, California, 90401.
Where are you seeing that? Are you looking on the donation?
That's on the form. 1507 7th Street, number 7B, Santa Monica, 90401. And you make the checks payable to Marianne Williamson for Congress.
This is so funny. Why are you saying that and I'm not?
It's on the form when the donate page, they say print out a form. It should be more prominent probably. It's worth noting.
Yeah.
Now, there's someone else who asks a really important question, Rachel.
And thank you to that person, by the way. I'm very moved and very, very grateful for that donation. Thank you.
Rachel Aaron, who I know here in the Bay Area, wants me to ask you, what are the practices that you do to sustain you in this? Because it seems to her, and actually a couple of other people made comments too, boy, this seems stressful. Are you going to hold out? So what is your practice of engaging this kind of battle in this way? How are you replenishing yourself? Where are your sources of energy and courage and heart in the midst of what might be at times pretty difficult?
Well, I've always said that my life works pretty well when I practice what I preach. So this is definitely already challenging me to live the life I purport to believe in. And I am a student of A Course in Miracles. I do the workbook. I try to practice those principles. I do transcendental meditation. And most importantly, I try to do the things that those things lead me to, and that is to interpret issues in such a way that frees me from neurotic limitations. You know, you were saying earlier, this is supposed to be fun. You know, if I'm not having fun, if it's not an experience of collective love, then I'm off. And the Course in Miracles says, only what you are not giving can be lacking in any situation. So, yeah, it's very stressful in some ways even that I did not expect, because they haven't even taken out the, you know, attack things yet. But just putting together a campaign, worrying about the money, worrying about, you know, putting together a group of people who are both politically savvy and yet mindful enough. A lot of times you find people who have the political chops but don't understand our conversation. Or you find people who understand our conversation but they're not embedded in some of the political things that absolutely are essential for a political campaign. So, yeah, it's a challenge, but I feel what I think everybody's feeling right now. Call to step it up and not just do the same old things that we already have been doing for so long that we could do them in our sleep.
Beautiful. I'm going to take, there are some other typed in questions I'd like to read to you in a minute, but let me take a live caller. I think this particular, this is a Florida area code 407 with the caller ID, Curtis Michelson. I'm not sure who it is. You're on the air.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you, Terry. And thank you, Marianne. I've been a fan of your work for many years. I think I even got married to one of your prayers in the Illuminati book. So
thank
you. He's spoken to my heart for a long time. So I'm very excited for your candidacy. Count me in the field, and I will certainly be giving a donation after this call.
Thank you.
And sure, absolutely. So many questions come to mind. Let me just try to focus on one. I really hear you bringing sort of systemic awareness and thinking deeply about, you know, such as money and politics and things like that, and getting at the root of issues. One of the things I was really hungry for during the whole healthcare debate, the run up to it and the conversation around it, was, and this is kind of what I wanted Obama to do, maybe naively, was say, get to the deeper cause of disease and lack of health in our country. And instead, we wound up in this very limited conversation around health insurance, tweaking at the edges. And I just wanted someone to get up and say, America, we are fat, and just speak to that in every dimension of what that means, of waste and lethargy and the collective energy that could be harnessed to drive, you know, the future of our country, to get healthy in every level. So I guess I hear you. I guess what I'm asking is, how would you have spoken, for example, to the healthcare debate in a deeper way, to use that? Because that's still an issue that we're battling with as a country, is how we move forward with taking care of each other. So I'll just take that.
Well, what you're saying is absolutely true. It's more of a healthcare bill, a sickness care bill, than it is a healthcare bill. That's the paradigm that it dwells within. But it goes back to the same thing we were talking about. Why? Because it's about the health insurance industry. It's about insurance. It's about the health insurance industry, the pharmaceutical industry, with Obamacare, as with everything else. Once the president was told what the health insurance companies would accept and allow, once the pharmaceuticals had weighed in on what they would accept and allow, he got us the biggest pile of crumbs he could.
Right.
So as long as you have multinational corporations getting theirs first, what we've done here is that we have recreated, subconsciously, we have recreated an aristocratic system. We repudiated it in 1776. We need to repudiate it again, this time not with, obviously, with war, but not with revolution, but with evolution and an awakening and awareness, and awareness such as what you said. So the mainstream medical conversation among the people of the United States has transitioned in the way that you describe, to a more holistic vision, to a more integrative vision. But you still have what is the political offering, reflecting the old consciousness, the old paradigm, and that is because it is in service to money more before it is in service to what you and I would see is the real needs of the people as expressed by a more sophisticated model of medical healing. And until, once again, you know, and the president had received as much money from the health insurance companies in that election as John McCain had. That's why they couldn't even have a they would not even allow a conversation about universal health care. And that's why, because it was about, would have been about health care. So these are all the things which lead us to just wake up, smell the coffee, and go, you know, until companies, you know, corporations don't get to say what they want first, and then us argue about the crumbs, these things are not going to change on the kind of fundamental levels that you and I think they should change.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Curtis.
Sure.
Thank you.
There are several questions by people outside the United States wondering if it's okay for them to donate. Is it?
If they're not American citizens, then no. Only U.S. citizens can contribute to an American election. But they have Facebook and Twitter and et cetera and conversations with American citizens, so I so appreciate the that question coming from our friends who are not American citizens. So no, it's not legal for you to send money, but send your best wishes, please. Please put it on your social media. I'm sure you know a lot of people who are American citizens who you could help awaken to what is going on here. You know, it is a larger global conversation, obviously, but what we're doing here is an American election. So no, only U.S. citizens can contribute.
Okay, good. I wish it were different at times, because what happens in the U.S. Congress affects the whole world, but it's true. We don't want outside influence.
No, it's pretty profoundly correct, actually, that it is the way that it is.
Yeah, I have another caller with a New York telephone number with the listed name Dennis Salibi. You're on the air.
Hi there. Wow. so excited to be talking with you guys. Marion, big fan. Tremendous.
Thank you.
Tremendous. This is really excellent news, and it's just what the country needs, I think, is this new spirit involved in running the country, you know. And I'm a New Yorker. I was had a great job in Hurricane Sandy, and then I started volunteering my time towards the relief effort. And it was so much to do around that relief. It actually caused me to quit my job, which was a great job. I've had the opportunity to work with a lot of politicians in the New York area. I was very involved in lobbying for the Sandy Relief Bill, went to Washington, worked with state senators here as well. And now I find myself not only without work, because I quit my job to do the relief work, but also without that much work to do for Sandy relief, because it's, you know, over a year now and a lot has been remediated. So I'm happy to tell you that I'm very seriously considering moving to Los Angeles.
Wow.
To be a part of volunteering for your campaign and helping you to accomplish this.
Well, I'm
That's
very
how much
moved,
moved.
By, I'm very moved by that. You know, I know that what you saw working with the victims of the hurricane and all of that, everything that you've been through. You've seen things. It's touched you in that place. Sometimes, you know, they say in AA, every problem comes bearing its own solution. Sometimes it's when we are at work doing what we can to eradicate human suffering that we become wise at last. So it's funny. People think, well, I'm going to sacrifice my good to help other people. But really the life of sacrifice is the life before we show up to help other people. And when we show up to help other people, that's when our dharma, that's when our real path is revealed to us. And I'm honored that you would feel that that path would lead you to be in the center of this particular action out here. So
yeah,
if you come out here, come say hi. I look forward to meeting you.
Yeah, and nothing could be more true, too, because I feel like the volunteer work I've done has made me a new man with a new life. And it's really is when I started getting involved in what you were doing and reading about, reading your stuff. So, I'm really looking forward to coming out there. Is Hermosa Beach part of your district? I was looking
sure
at
Hermosa. Sure
is,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right, you can be on the
thank
lookout
you,
for
thank
so
you, thank you.
I look forward to helping you.
Thank you so much.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Dennis. That's really delightful and surprising and exciting to hear.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Well, we have a lot of people expressing a lot of appreciation for your candidacy, Marianne. I want to just read a couple of those messages that among many. One of them is Ken in Portland is just wanting to let you know how grateful he is that you are not just talking the talk but walking the walk. You are, in my way of thinking, one of the few who blends authentic thought and action. Janice K. Simmons from Tucson said, this 75-year-old on Social Security has made a donation of $100.
Oh.
So come on, seniors, let's make a difference.
Oh, I tell you, that really is very moving. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Yeah, that's from Janice K. Simmons. Thank you, Janice. And there's actually quite a bit more coming through right now. We do have another live caller, Deborah Boyer. Hello.
Hi, Terry. Hi, Marianne. Thank you so much for your candidacy and your wonderful conversation here. I'm curious if you've considered creating an alternative Citizens United and making alliances with progressive business leaders in the conscious capitalism field, such as John Mackey, Evan Williams, Tony Hsieh, and even Michael Bloomberg, to counter the impact?
Well, those efforts are being made. I'm a big fan of John Mackey. He's a friend. I think what conscious capitalism is doing is fantastic. You know, we have in America and most countries, and I guess all countries and to some extent, there's the public sector and there's the private sector. And within the private sector, all of those things that you're talking about are being done. They're important. They're part of the uplifting of energy. But in order for the kind of shift to occur that we want, it can't just be the private any more than it can just be the public. So the calling of my heart is to be part of the public sector in this area. You know, you can't, you know, you say an alternative Citizens United. Well, there is no alternative Citizens United. We have one Supreme Court, and that is what determines the laws of the United States, you know, what laws are deemed constitutional or unconstitutional. So this is about both and. This is not about either or. And I think the whole point of this candidacy is that we have to include, my feeling, that we have to include the public sector in our work and not just stay within the private. And, of course, Michael Bloomberg, of course, represents both, John Mackey doing extraordinary things within the private sector and so forth.
Mm. Thank you, Deborah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Deborah.
Okay. Well, I want to go to just a few more of the questions that have been typed in. There are some substantive questions, and I don't think we can get into all of them. One of them was asked actually leading up to the interview by Igor Lemansky, who took a look at of Salt Lake City. He said, on your website, you mention Oregon's legislation to offer free college tuition as a piece of model legislation to address the education problem in America. Are there other novel initiatives happening around the U.S. that you feel could help move our country in the right direction?
Well, actually, California has, I mentioned earlier, you know, the question you had asked, Terry, about whether or not I could, quote-unquote, split the vote. And the reason I can't is because of the open primary. Another thing that has happened here in California that has opened up the space for me to run, it expands democracy itself, is the depoliticalization of our gerrymandering. I think a lot of people probably don't realize how politicized gerrymandering works. What it has done is created a situation in which political parties draw the lines of districts in such a way as to protect the incumbent, making a system where candidates choose the voters rather than voters choosing the candidates. That's why you have, for instance, in the current House of Representatives, you have the Republicans in control, even though there were a million more Democrats than Republicans who voted in that election. And it's why when we have elections next year, only 17 seats are really considered in play. California, along with efforts in Iowa and in Florida, interestingly enough, called for depoliticized gerrymandering, which occurred a few years ago in California, opening up the space. It makes way for real democracy, because that's what we have here is a crisis in democracy. So I think depoliticized gerrymandering is extremely, extremely important in really saving our democracy, revitalizing it. So absolutely, and to that question, I think one of the most important state initiatives does have to do with depoliticizing our gerrymandering. Also, a lot of early education initiatives on a state level, the issue of preschool that I was talking about before, and how this puts a child onto a probability track of incarceration too often, in terms of they're not going to preschool. A lot of the early education initiatives are on a state level. And then this free college, you know, this issue of, you know, you have so many American young people who are just so saddled with these awful school loans in order to go to college. Many are just throwing up their hands and saying, why bother? There's not a job for me anyway. And so what you get, if you have enough generations of that, only people with money will have educated children, which you can't have that and have a democracy. So a lot of these initiatives, like, you know, Oregon is the first one that I know of to actually put something in place along that line where they're trying the college thing. And what that is, by the way, is that the people who are performing at the level of excellence academically that would allow them to be in that program then are given an education in the state of Oregon, and then they will pay, I think for 10 years, 2% of their income they pay back. You know, and paying it forward, really. So that is something, you know, once again, states as laboratories of reform, and it's why, you know, what happens in our state government is absolutely as important in a different kind of way as what happens in our federal government.
Now, there's a lot that needs to be done in terms of electoral reform. I had meant to ask you a question about the two-party monopoly, and Laura Brainerd from Inverness asks about publicly funded campaigns. And cites Dennis Kucinich arguing for a constitutional amendment for this. How do you see the practical steps that can be taken now, the first steps, the baby steps toward more radical electoral reform?
Well, as Dennis proposed, until we have a constitutional amendment that outlaws the undue influence of money and possibly the establishment that corporations do not have the rights of personhood, this is impossible. The Citizens United decision took away from Congress the legal ability to make campaigns public or even to, in any real way, even monitor them or bring any kind of serious election reform, campaign finance reform into play. And that's why the people have to speak now, because the Supreme Court's already spoken with Citizens United. And there's another case that they might take, the McCutcheon case, which even challenges the individual limit. I mean, it's terrible. It's really crisis level, and that's one of the reasons I'm running. If I thought this debate would happen without my running, you know, I have a nice life. My daughter was like, Mommy, what are you doing? You know, why would you run into this? But I think many of us are feeling this is not like just kind of sort of we have a problem here. This is a serious problem here. And let us not be the first generation to wimp out on this. So on course correcting when America needs to course correct. So like Dennis, I believe, and everybody who's really taking a serious look at this, believes that a constitutional amendment is what's going to be necessary. You can look at online at something called the American Anti-Corruption Act. You can look at Robert Reich, Common Cause, an organization. You can look at an organization called Free and Equal. You can look at an organization called Move to Amend. You know, this conversation is out there, in other words, and you can investigate it and research and be part of it to whatever extent you feel moved. And then, of course, in my case and the case of others, you know, support candidates who are actually making that stand.
Wonderful. Well, Marianne, I want to read one more comment from a listener before we have our final comments and finish up our time together. Ila Reynolds in Bend, Oregon says, I'm so excited about your work and now this step into a deeper commitment level of practicing what you teach. I'm moved, I'm touched, and will do all I can to promote your political candidacy. Even though I live in Oregon, I am now contacting all my friends in LA to support you in more visible ways in your area as well as contributing financially. I'm grateful to be able to support in that way. Very exciting, courageous, radical. This shows how radical Jesus is and how you are embodying his truths.
Wow. Once again, I'm moved and I'm honored, and I hope that I continue with this campaign to do work that makes people feel, yeah, I'm glad I made that investment. She's doing what I would want her to do. I hope that that's people's feelings and that there's a sense of depth here for all of us in our participation. So thank you so much for that.
Wonderful. Well, thank you, everybody, for joining us. Make sure to remember the websites Marianne, MarianneFor, for Congress.com, MarianneForCongress.com, and Marianne.com. You're also invited to tell your friends about the work we're doing here. If you value it and you want to support it, help other people tune in at BeyondAwakeningSeries.com, and you're also invited to go to Terry Patten, TerryPatten.com, and sign up for my mailing list. Thank you so much for joining Marianne and me today. Thank you so much, Marianne, for your leadership, for your passion, and for your eloquence, and
well,
for
right
cutting
back
through
at
so
you.
Much.
Right back at you, Terry. I'm so grateful, and truly thank you, and I hope we meet again over the airwaves or in person as we walk this path.
I hope so, too. I will be doing what I can to support you throughout this whole process.
Thank you. Thank you.
Take care.
God bless.
I officially endorse Marianne Williamson.
Hey, thank you, babe. God bless you, everybody. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.